Last week we talked a little bit about the disciples and the struggle that they had with coming to faith in the resurrection. We noted specifically that they really were not anticipating it. It was not some sort of wish fulfillment on their part. Faith didn't come to them that way. Faith came because they actually saw Jesus, okay? And they actually experienced the resurrection. We mentioned also that that probably was the one thing, it almost had to be the one thing, that happened to them to make them turn their lives around so much that they were willing to die for this belief. They turned the world upside down with it, okay? And it's affected us ever since. Jesus, in this section we have here, does in fact appear to them and then appears also to Thomas with them. Now, we haven't quite moved past this initial stage of belief yet, all right, to the point where they become witnesses to the entire world. But we're getting very close to that time, at least in terms of how we see this story playing out in their lives and how we see their experiences with the resurrection. The episodes we're going to look at today kind of help explain a little bit of what happened and why it was they came to this belief. The first thing we see them here is them behind locked doors. That's kind of an interesting thing to me. Verses both 19 and 26. In both occasions, they're behind locked doors. They're still afraid. Jesus himself was, let me say that, I'm about ready to say Jesus was intimidated. He wasn't intimidated. People tried to intimidate him. He had many enemies. As we read in class this morning, as Steve was going over John chapter 11, it's very clear that the Pharisees were dead against him, even though they knew what he did. They were against him because they were afraid he was a threat to their power. He was a threat to their own administration. So there are a number of reasons why they felt intimidated, and we find that playing itself out also after they began the church. Early on in the history of the church, the persecution came from the Jewish leaders. We see that in Acts chapter 5, verses 27 through 32. The leaders have called the disciples in front of them, and they're expressing their own guilt, said, "You're making us guilty of this man's death." I think there's sort of implied there that they had become a threat to their influence, because a lot of people were coming over to belief in Jesus Christ after some miracles that the apostles performed. Later on in Acts chapter 13 and Acts 17, we see that outside Palestine, the Jews once again were still a threat to them. In fact, in Acts chapters both 13 and 17, we read that it's jealousy that's moving them to try to intimidate the disciples in the message of Christ. Later on, it's not too long after that, that the Gentiles get into the act, those who are not Jewish people. They get very intimidated, and we see in Acts chapter 19 that their economy is being threatened because Paul is preaching there are these gods that they are selling these trinkets for really are not gods at all. And so their economic base is being intimidated and threatened. When you start threatening people's money, then you got a problem, okay? Well, anyway, we see that the intimidation takes place. They're still in that stage right at this point. They're still intimidated by the Jews. Today, the intimidation shows up in different ways, but it's still there. One of the things that we see today, number one, is that Christianity has become still a threat to other religions and governments. Very interesting to me to read more of the totalitarian governments, usually communism and socialism in particular. They're still intimidated by Christianity. And there's a good reason for that. They know there's another king. Just like Herod learned there was another king and he was intimidated by it, you still have that today. But there's another way it kind of happens for us, perhaps living in this country. We hear things like, you know, it's okay to be a Christian, but it's strictly a private matter, not fit for some sort of public discussion and more. And it certainly shouldn't be some sort of thing that has a part to play in our public discussions of policy. They want your faith to be strictly a private matter and not have anything to do with the way you live or anything the way to do with I live. As long as you keep it to yourself and don't really get serious about changing your behavior or seek to impose it on others, it's okay. But you see, that's kind of putting it behind locked doors. They don't want it out in the open. They don't want it to play a role. Piety without real life significance is what they would prefer. Keep it behind locked doors. Very interesting here that one of the things that Jesus tells his disciples when he comes to them behind locked doors is, I'm sending you. There's a very strong implication here that it was never meant to stay behind locked doors. Now, we've seen that take place, or at least we do see it. As I mentioned, the several places in the book of Acts, they get intimidated. People keep trying to tell them, put it behind locked doors. Put it behind locked doors. It doesn't belong out here. Yeah, it's okay if you believe it. Just don't let it mean anything, basically. They and the church, the disciples and the church that they establish, eventually are going to take up the mantle that Jesus gives them of going out and telling everyone about the resurrection. When he says, I am sending you, he is giving them a divine commission. And you see, we take up that divine commission to be witnesses to the world. In our lives, in our statements, we can't just say, well, we'll keep it all to ourselves, and when we're at work, it doesn't have any bearing to play on our ethical behavior or anything like that. That's just not what was meant to be when Jesus said, I'm sending you. We are meant to be witnesses. They will act as emissaries from God. Listen to how he says it. As the Father has sent me, so I'm sending you. See, Jesus grounds the authority for doing this in some divine power. God, the Father. The Father of Jesus Christ, the creator of the universe, passes the commission through his Son onto these human beings. And later on into the church that are representatives of him. They will act as God's emissaries to the world. Now, as becomes very apparent here, one of the things that does happen, this idea of the resurrection, it's kind of like they can't really suppress it. You know, it's such a powerful motivator for them that they realize, yeah, this guy actually conquered death. The one thing that we're all afraid of, he conquers it. It's like in Jeremiah. Jeremiah says, I tried to not talk about God, but he said there was a fire within inside of me. I couldn't keep quiet. That's kind of what's happening to the disciples here. A fire is being ignited inside of them. And they really can't keep quiet. Why should they? That something this powerful has happened to them. Others will seek to tarnish their witness by lies and persecution, just like it was with Jesus. We read in chapter 10 and verse 20 that they said of Jesus, well, why listen to him? He's demon-possessed and he's insane. Now, I don't know if they'll use those exact words with us, but they just lie, you know? Why try to, parry our arguments with reasonable arguments when you can just say, well, they're just liars or they're just stupid or, you know, they get very condescending about who we are. I'm simply trying to say, it's not going to matter. We shouldn't allow that to matter for us. We have to get the message from beyond the locked doors of ourselves and just be witnesses. I'm not saying you need to go out on the corner and stand there and preach to everybody, but you know what? You need to let your faith show. That's what it was intended to be, not something to be kept behind locked doors. But we move to another thing that I think is also a kind of representative of today's generation. Demanding proof or avoiding commitment. I call this the Thomas generation. Just listen to this for just a moment. Thomas wasn't there with the original 10 when they saw Jesus for the first time. When he says to them, peace be with you as the Father has sent me, even so I send you. Thomas is not there. I don't know where Thomas is at this point, but he's not there. So Thomas says to them, well, I'm not going to believe till I see. And I kind of want to give Thomas a little bit of a fair shake here, okay? Because we tend to label him the doubter. But in fact, kind of like all the other disciples were that as well. We tend to separate him from them because he wasn't there. And we say, well, he was just a doubter. Well, take a look at verse 20. It says, when he had said, this was the first time that the disciples saw him, or at least together as a group. When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. That looks to me like the original disciples, they weren't ready to believe until they saw his hands and his side either. So in a sense, Thomas is really not asking for anything more than the other disciples got. I don't know if he knew that, but the fact is, you know, they didn't come to faith until they saw him either. And so, you know, let's kind of give Thomas a little bit of a break here. Maybe he should have. But you know what? The rest of us have got to rely on the same witness that Thomas wouldn't believe in. We got to rely on people who said they saw him. That's what our faith is founded on, isn't it? The rest of us have to rely on their witness, especially the witness of those who had seen for themselves. Now, Jesus does say here, does he not? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Well, that's kind of the rest of us. That's all of us, as a matter of fact. It's interesting that John here, he doesn't do what's happened in several other Gospels. In Mark chapter 16 and verse 14, Mark notes that Jesus rebukes the disciples for not believing the witness of other people. You remember last week we talked about how when Mary Magdalene went back and told them, they thought she was just talking in some idle tale. And they didn't believe her. And Jesus rebukes them for that a little bit. In Luke chapter 24 and 25, when Jesus is talking to the two men on the road to Emmaus, he says, he kind of chides them for being slow of heart not to believe the scriptures. Well, John doesn't even bring that up here. He's unconcerned about the rebuke. I think maybe he just says, okay, let's go from here. Let's just move on to being believers. But I think today you have a kind of, there's a number of people that seem to be kind of in this Thomas generation. And I'm going to, you know, maybe slander Thomas's name a little bit here. I'm going to use it. He shouldn't be just the only doubter, but I'm going to use it just to kind of represent what I think some people do today. Many people seem to me, they want Christians to prove themselves before they'll believe. And I hear this from other ministers. I read about it, that there seems to be a whole generation of people growing up that some have even left the faith because Christians haven't really measured up. You know, we're not as perfect as people seem to think we ought to be. And they're kind of waiting for us to demonstrate our perfection to them or to do enough good works to feel like, okay, God must really be with you. And I'm not trying to say here we should not worry about trying to measure up. Okay, I'm not saying here that we should not worry about demonstrating our love to one another and showing that Christ is with us. But you see, what happens with a number of people is the responsibility for their own faith, they seem to place that on other people and maybe a little bit even on God to prove himself first. Waiting for the church to be perfect may just be the means of refusing to confront real life issues of their own sins or avoiding the demands of the gospel. And I guess I feel like if I ever had anybody tell me that, well, you know, the church is, you've heard it probably all your life. Church is full of hypocrites. That's why I'm not going. You know, it's really the same thing. And all you can say is, well, yeah, probably. So, you know, I mean, at some point, it's not a matter of allowing everybody else to demand to keep me from becoming a believer. Because my faith is not resting on whether or not you're perfect or not. And your faith is not resting on whether or not I'm perfect or anybody else is perfect. Yeah, it ought to be that we ought to live like Christ and not just be hypocrites. But, you know, Christianity is still true, even if Christians aren't perfect examples of it. Just like the resurrection was true, even if Thomas hadn't seen it yet. It was still true, and it will continue to be true. Neither God nor the Christians have to prove themselves to the satisfaction of others. I think maybe the Thomas generation may be just trying to cop out of belief. Maybe that's a little harsh, but I just think it's something that we need to we need to consider, we need to maybe deal with as we're talking to people. You know, there are people who are just going to use the hypocrite thing all the time. And I believe it's just a way of them sort of keeping from coming to faith themselves. Hypocrites are always going to be in the church. None of us are ever going to measure up perfectly to what Christ wants us to be. Yeah, we need to keep moving in that direction, but let's not allow ourselves either to become the Thomas generation. But there is a group here. There are people here who have accepted Jesus by faith, and we do it because of faith in the witnesses. Again, verse 29 of John's letter here. Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and have yet believed. Well, again, that is us. We depend on the witness of the disciples to give us our faith. You know, if you went into a legal system, you went into the courts, and if you were trying to convict someone of a crime, you'd look for evidence. But one of the things you would also look for is testimony. The testimony of legitimate witnesses, of people who perhaps don't have some axe to grind, even though some of those witnesses are like that. And one of the things lawyers do is they try to discredit the witnesses. Okay? Why isn't the testimony of these witnesses enough for belief for some people? Well, I'm sure there's a multiplicity of reasons why it's not good enough. What I'm simply suggesting is it's not unusual for us to depend on testimony for us to believe certain things. I've never been to Moscow. I've seen pictures of people that say it's Moscow, but I have to believe that when people tell me Moscow exists, it's because they've been there. Or we have enough historical records to demonstrate that there's a place called Moscow. Now, John seems to believe that the witnesses are sufficient for us, does he not? Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. John depends on the fact that you're going to believe because he says, well, this is what we've seen and believed. We've experienced this for ourselves. And really, that's what it is. Is John a credible witness? Can we trust his testimony? Well, all of us do, and I would suggest that we have no good reason why we shouldn't. Is there corroboration for his testimony? Well, Paul tells us there are other witnesses. In fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 6, Paul tells us that there were more than 500 people who had seen him at one time. And he challenges the Corinthians. He says, look, you can go talk to some of them are still alive. I don't know if Paul said, I'll go get him and bring him for you if you want to, but he could have done that. You know, he could have paid to have him come and give their testimony. Well, should they believe him? Why not? Unless you have a good reason that the witnesses are not good witnesses, then probably you should believe the witnesses if they are truth tellers. Okay. We believe because of John's testimony. That's why we spend a lot of time studying it and thinking about it and reflecting on it for ourselves and what it means for us. John's message is for all of us. Eternal life. John wants that for us. You know, John doesn't really demand anything for himself here. This is a free testimony available for all. And I think it's very significant that John and all the other, well, we don't know that John was actually killed for his faith. He was tortured in some ways. But all the others, they lost their lives to spread this message. And I realize today there seem to be a lot of people in the name of Jesus who are padding their own pockets, you know, to make money off of this. But there are enough who aren't doing that we should probably believe that their testimony was a good one. If nothing else, go all the way back to John. Go all the way back to Peter and the other disciples who saw him, who said, we were there on the mountain. This person that we, this life that we saw and touched and heard and so forth, you know, we're witnesses of that. That's what we got here. That's what John is doing for us. He really doesn't demand anything for himself. Three times in this passage, John notes that Jesus says to the disciples, peace be with you. In 19, 21 and 26. Every time he comes to them in this section, what he offers to them is a blessing of peace. Are life and peace worth the cost of believing? I think that's not only a challenge for ourselves when we're having our moments of doubt, but I think it's also maybe one of those little things we can say to our friends. You know, are life and peace worth this? Well, yeah, we think they are. We know Jesus isn't offering us freedom from tribulation. You know, when people say, well, if my life was perfect, if I didn't suffer so much, I'd believe. Yeah, you know, that's probably not going to happen. But the peace that comes through hope and eternal salvation, that's what Jesus is offering them. And he says it to them three times. It's kind of an amazing thing to people who are cowering behind locked doors to tell them peace. Basically, don't be afraid. Basically, I'm with you. Can we say basically, unlock the doors? Don't cower behind locked doors. Don't let your faith be something. Don't let people intimidate you because of your faith. Your faith, you're on the right track. You got peace and you got life. My encouragement today, as always, is to try to see for you. Just keep believing the testimony. Accept the gifts of life and peace. Let those things be the things that drive you every day. Don't put your heart and your testimony behind a locked door of unbelief.